Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 23, delivered on April 22, 2019. The title of this lecture is Cash Flow Analysis Example.
Today, an example of cash flow analysis. Now, this example, and you know very well, I am certainly not a PowerPoint professor, but this one I built as a PowerPoint in this extremely accelerated course that I do for these people who come from developing countries. I teach them financial analysis. Specifically, for a lot of the people that I teach, they are in charge of a program where the government wants to invest in private corporations for the purpose of building those corporations up, strengthening them, getting them on their feet, and then releasing them in 5 years or so. The idea there is that this is sort of, it's not, I would not characterize this as a socialist thing at all, because everyone involved in this is in it to make money. The government actually wants to be able to come out of this in a better position financially when it spins these off than it was when it went into the position. And of course, these companies want to come out strong and financially capable. The idea there being that ultimately what this does is this benefits everyone in the country, because there's employment goes up, these companies start paying taxes, so the government gets more revenue, all of those good things. So it's not, I wouldn't characterize this as a socialist thing at all. It is actually more of a macro capitalism, where the capital is being infused by the government itself. Ultimately, we would like to see these companies starting to get money from other sources than the government, which is where the Chinese and the Saudis especially come in, because they can deliver large amounts of money to these countries without the government having to do anything. But anyway, all of that having been said, the idea is rather simple. Okay, we need to know how to look at these companies and see if they're worth investing in. Well, that boils down to, okay, let's see the present value of their future expected cash flows. How much is this company actually worth? What would happen if we put this money in? Would that make it worth more? And, okay, so if that's the case, then we have a go on the project. Get the company in, get the money in there, grow the company, see if we can keep on that projected expected cash flow pattern that we're hoping for, and then at the end, at some terminal point, get rid of it. This is not a marriage. This is a temporary arrangement. In other words, the government wants out at some point. Now, there are a lot of companies in the United States that do this too. Particularly these holding companies will buy into companies that are in distress. They get it at a cheap price, they infuse capital into it, then they oversee operations in terms of service to the customers or whatever, in terms of marketing campaigns, in terms of a lot of personnel management. And then their goal is to dump those companies out at a profit down the road. Examples of this include, okay, this is probably a place you don't eat. Well, let me try this. Sir, do you eat at Red Lobster?
Sometimes.
Really? No. It's considered kind of an old people's restaurant, or a middle-aged. You know, I go in there, and I see people that look, God, you're old, and they look at me, God, you're old. So But there was a restaurant chain that was in a great deal of distress. It had fallen down on hard times simply because it lost its ability to hold market share. It lost its ability to innovate. It lost its ability to bring in customers, increasing competition in the big plates market. Well, increasing competition in that sit-down restaurants market, moderately upscale, et cetera. So company walks in there, okay, we're going to take this over. It's at a bargain, and we are going to then infuse capital and infuse management, grow the company, and then with the idea that we can unleash this thing in 10 years and we'll make money on the spinoff. We'll sell it at a price well above what we got it at. The question is that horizon value. Is the present value of that horizon value and the cash flows along the way going to be more than the costs right up front of taking over this company and the cash flows that are negative to build it back up? The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. We just have to, but we do want to kind of make it happen. And so that sets up trying to show these folks from these good people, the deputy ministers and technocrats of these second world developing countries, here's how you do it. Here's how you look at the cash flows. Here are the pieces of it. I'm not going to show you the whole story in one session because I have to build it up, but I also have to do this all in 2 weeks. Whereas with you, I have a whole semester to do it. Truth be told, it's a lot more fun to do it here than it is in a blowdown of 2 weeks. But let me go through it. And I'm going to show you a PowerPoint. I'm going to walk this as a PowerPoint. I, like I said, you know I don't do this very often. But I've built this up, and it's like just Excel pretty much. And I'll show you how the sheets look in Excel as I go through them. Now, let me take you up here to the top of this. God, this is awful. I should be shot for doing something like this. Slideshow. You can tell I don't do this too often. Hate slideshows. Now, capital budgeting, okay, we are going to put money in. And we're going to need money to put money in. So, we're going to find out how much we need, what the benefits are, what the costs are, and then get some idea of what the terminal value of what we're doing is. And hope that that's good enough that we can take on this project, help this company out, or have the, in this case, I'm going to give you a couple of examples that were from actual companies, and see their logic. Now, as I tell these folks in the MDI program, these are simplified numbers, but the companies are actually real. In one case, I had to use a phony company name because I couldn't get permission from them, but I did get a hold of their cash flow statements for the project. Now remember, everything is incremental. You don't look at other cash flows, only the cash flows that are part of the project. That's called incremental cash flow analysis. In other words, we identify this project, and we tend to avoid these words like synergy. Well, this could have synergistic effects on the rest of the corporation. Yes, no. Leave that fluff out of it. Let's look at this on its own. It would be the same thing as if I'm looking at your life. Well, we look at, you know, not just his cash flows, but look at all the wonderful benefits he's going to do for the world and how much other people are going to make because they've seen his shining face. Yeah, maybe that's true, but we can't look at that. We should not be trying to, well, we'll have these positive effects on the rest of the company. Most likely, you're going to have negative effects. If things go south, it's going to turn your whole brand into your whole company down. So let's just leave it so that we're talking only about the increments. Now, we're going to forecast incremental statement earnings in a pro forma. And remember what I said, pro forma is just a projection. Pro forma is a fancy word for a projected financial statement. And then we got to go through that free cash flow analysis. Remember, you take the net income and then you add back the depreciation, subtract the capital expenditures, and then subtract out the change in net working capital. It's that formula I gave you, and it'll be here too. And by the way, I will put this, a limited version of this up so you can see this, but I can't use the whole thing because then someone's going to rip it off and post it on some of those crap websites, and then I lose my copyright on it. So it'll be a limited version of this. Okay. You got to watch out when you're doing incremental free cash flow analysis. By the way, if any of you are ever planning to do a business, do it right. Do this. Be honest with yourself up front instead of just hoping things work out. Because if you go for any kind of money from other people, angel investors, private equity, banks, they're going to want to see exactly what I'm doing here. Quick story before I go on. We have some angel investors that sometimes work with us to get money for student projects, student startups. And we had been sort of like, okay, we see who wants to start a business. We tell them, get your plan together, get your presentation. We're going to bring this money here to the table, and you have to talk that money into coming to your dog whistle. And it was 2 years ago, we had this one team came before the angels, and they gave a very good, strong presentation, very dynamic young man. And then one of the heavies, a heavy angel, said, how soon can you get us your business plan? And one of those bright young men said, well, you know, who does a business plan anymore? Yep. That was about $2 million that those kids lost with that kid opening his pie hole like that. Who does a business plan anymore? Well, about everyone who's not a moron like you. I get a little harsh when it's real money. I got to get you ready for a world where angel investors don't give money. They're not angels in that sense. They don't give money for nonsense like that. Look at the options that are available to you and in terms of the money that can come in. You can get money through private placements of equity. You can get bank loans. If you're a startup, you're probably not going to get money in a stock offering on a firm underwriting. You're not going to get money by issuing bonds that will be bought by the heavy investors on Wall Street. You're going to get money from private placements, 505, 506, loans from banks, and the banks will just eat you alive. They'll want to see this. They're willing to move money into startups. The community banks have a duty to do that, and other banks will listen to you. They'll talk to you. The Small Business Administration has a program. It's not nearly what it used to be. It used to be a very big program for providing capital to startups, but it's not there anymore. Any way you cut it, though, you got to know what you're asking for. Are you looking for equity money? Are you looking for debt money? Are you looking for some kind of a hybrid? Like, for example, a kind of debt that can be converted into equity down the road? Sometimes there are investors who say, look, we're going to lend you money, and you're going to owe us. But if this company looks like it's actually going to fly, we want to be in on the action. We want a position in the stock so that they can convert it over from debt to equity. In other words, it might be a convertible debt instrument. Find out what the options are, what your first choice preference is, and what your fallback is. You might have a first choice of debt, and then a fallback, okay, we'll sweeten the pot. Instead of debt, we'll have debt that's convertible into equity at your choice. So keep that in mind when you're doing this. Now, the process is, understand the difference between the capital budget and the capital budgeting. The capital budget is the money. The capital budgeting is how it's going to be used. The capital budget is the money. The capital budgeting is how it's going to be used. The what and the how. And then the incremental earnings. In other words, how much extra is this project going to contribute to the overall of this business entity? In the case of these programs I was telling you about in the developing countries, how much money is this going to take away from, and then we hope add to the overall budget of the government of the country over the period of the holding period? And I can't emphasize this enough. You should go into projects like this with an exit. If you are the investor, even the people who do the project, let me make sure you understand this. You have worked so hard on this project of yours. It's a business, I mean, you've given up hours and hours and weeks and months of your life. You did not go to concerts. You did not go when your friend said, time for a crawl, and they're already drunk, so you're behind them. You got to get there, and you say no. You've put a lot of your life into this project. And then it works. 5 years down the road, Google calls you and says, we want to buy this company of yours. You have to leave. We want to buy it. You're not in it anymore if we buy it. And we'll pay you $100 million. Now, in your thinking process, well, what are you going to say to Google? This is my baby. I'm going to keep it. Oh, no. Or are you going to say, oh, yeah. Which one?
I would say this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't be sentimental. Never be sentimental about this. There have been a few who, legendary stories, I ain't going to give this up. I'm going to hold on to it. And of course, down the road, it crashes because eventually the original owners are going to screw the company over because they're a fixed factor of production. They refuse to let go, and the company begins to suffer because they cannot be new blood. They cannot bring in new blood because they're still going to want to control it, and they won't know what the future holds like younger people would. Okay? And that's one of the problems with a lot of companies now. One of my fundamental analytics is, look at a company. Do you have the same family generation after generation after generation? Do they hold on without looking to new people, new ideas, new blood? That's a sell on my side. That's a long term, get this out of my portfolio. So, yeah, just get rid of it. Don't be sentimental. Okay, first things first, cash flows in the typical project. Your initial outlay. How much money are you going to put in? Straight up. You're going to buy equipment. Well, this is something that amazes me. A lot of young people come to me and they want to talk about their ideas, their new projects. And I say, okay, let's talk startup. I want to see you bring me a budget for the equipment. Well, this is just a bunch of ideas. We won't really have any equipment. I'm polite to them. I say, get the F out of my office. Yeah, you're going to have equipment. You're going to have machines. You're going to have computers. You're going to have phones. You're going to have internet, even if you're one of these newfangled apps companies. Okay, and then in initial development costs. Well, we got this guy who knows my friends, and he's really good at writing apps. So the rest of you are just fluff, and he's the company, right? Well, yeah, we'll let him have some. You'll let him have some? You're going to let him have the lion's share, because otherwise he's going to figure out that you're a bunch of dumbheads who are using him, and he's going to take his ideas and market them to someplace else, like a Google or an Apple. So don't think you're the big idea guys and you're just going to use some genius as the main point of getting a company running. Don't ever think that. And by the way, I'm giving you a whole lot about 40 years of experience creating companies and advising and consulting. Now, there's going to be in the initial, this is kind of an important thing. There is going to be a balloon on your net working capital because you're going to have to bring in current assets before you make a single sale. You're going to have to up your inventory. In the initial phase, you're going to have to up the inventory. You're probably going to have to put money down for insurance. Liability insurance, E&O, errors and omissions, possibly D&O, directors and officers. So that is an initial, before there is ever one sale, you've got to have all of this set up on the current assets. Current assets are going to go up, and I'll show you some examples here in just a little bit. But that's going to, and by the way, interestingly enough, though, down at the end of the project, your working capital goes down because you burn off the last of the inventory, you don't renew your insurance premiums for the liability, E&O, D&O, and all that, and there are other things that, like that. So at the beginning, net working capital balloons, and then it rides flat. You might have blurbs in it as inventory goes up and down with the demand cycle, but it stays pretty much flat, and then at the end, it collapses back down. You say, well, why pay attention to it anyway? Because the present value of what happens at the beginning, which is a negative, is going to be more than the exact same value as a present value at the end. So you have to do them separately. Again, if your inventory goes up by $100,000 at the beginning, right now, that's $100,000 right now. Present value of $100,000 that's happening right now is $100,000. Well, then that goes down by $100,000 at the termination of the project in year five. Well, the negative $100,000 5 years out is the present value of that is a lot less than $100,000. So it's not just a wash. So you have to do both parts of it to get this right. And I make it sound like this is really complicated. Actually, it's pretty easy once you get all the pieces. I just have to go through the pieces and talk to you about them. Now, to give you an example of a restaurant chain that was captured some years back, capturing company, the holding company that did the capture, and I wouldn't really call it a hostile takeover. There was some hard feelings, but they knew they had to have something because it was a good restaurant chain. It just was not doing good at all. It was closing stores. Customers were no longer coming in the way they had, and just competition was eating them alive. So it wasn't exactly a hostile takeover, but the startup, they had, of course, the takeover company paid money to take a commanding position in the equity of the restaurant chain. There's money. Then they had to go in. They had to clear out ovens, grills, freezers. Literally, they gutted the restaurants and the warehouses in some cases and put in new equipment before they could even start to realize cash flows. And also initial development costs. They had to pay companies that were experts in marketing. Okay, what is best practices in marketing now? What does this company do? How can we get from what they're doing to what they need to do? That was money out the door, right up front. Okay, we're going to spend that money. So remember that. Okay, now, into the pit of the years of operating it, you're going to have the extra revenues from this project. In the case of the restaurant chain, they were going to have the revenues coming in from people eating at the restaurant. They were going to have the extra costs of the people who work at the restaurants, who manage the districts and the regions of the restaurants. Those are going to be their costs now. They've got to recognize these are our costs. They have to recognize the tax effects. Now, if they're losing money, that might not be the worst thing in the world because that shields, there's where it shields revenue from other divisions of the company. So the tax affects both negative and positive. Just recognize them. Stop bitching about your taxes. It's someone else's problem. We just analyze the taxes on our pre-tax income. Now, during the life of the project, the current assets and the current liabilities will be moving from year to year. Your current liabilities will go up as you would go up as you don't pay bills. They'd go down if you pay bills. Your inventory, you might find that our initial inventory that we thought would be good for this project won't be enough. We'll probably have to bump it up from 50,000 units to say 70,000. This is especially true if you start getting successful, because in the case of that restaurant chain, what happened was that after about 3-4 years, it worked. People started coming back to the restaurant. So in other words, their original inventory levels that they thought would be sufficient, well, that were sufficient to get this project going, suddenly they were stocking out. I'm sorry, we don't have that on the menu tonight, sir. You don't ever want to have that. You try never to have that. So, okay, we've got to go from inventory levels going in 60,000, out 60,000, to in 80,000, out 80,000. Okay, you just had to build inventory because you were starting to get some success in your business, for heaven's sakes. And then, okay, that's the ongoing. Terminal. Like I said, this isn't a forever thing. You are in this for a specific period of time. And a good investor understands that. Just like, this is the words that I said to the folks, I say to the folks who come in to talk about this from other countries. You are not this company. You don't want to own it forever. You do not want to be socialists. You do not want to be communists. You are in this for 5 years, or whatever number of years you are saying to me, but it ain't forever. So we want an end date, a terminal cash flow point. Year seven, fine. Year seven, we end this. And let's see what happens at year seven. Let's see what our projections are for year seven. We're going to dump equipment. We're going to sell it to some losers who want it. We hope. We also might have to pay money for some of this equipment to get rid of it. I mean, if this is environmental hazard, getting rid of that warehouse is going to mean that we have to pay environmental remediation costs, shutdown costs. We got to get rid of it. We got to close it up. We've got to say our sighs and goodbyes to some employees. If we had these managers who were there for the project, we get rid of them. We also shut down operations in other ways, too. That might cost some money. There are shutdown costs. You say, well, we just walk away. Yeah, that's not how it works. That may have been the way it was years ago. You go up there on Vernon Avenue, just before you get to the Veterans Parkway, you're going to see right across from each other two companies that walked away. Hey, we're done with this. One of those companies walked away long enough ago that now it's just a disaster for the community. The community will have to deal with it, or some investor who wants to put a huge amount of money in for something that wasn't their problem. The one across the street, it's shut down. It can't even be dumped on someone else because the laws now say you got to fix that. It's got underground storage tanks. Both of them were gas stations. The one was abandoned years ago as a gas station. They just left the underground storage tanks there. Parked there, probably got some hydrocarbons, gasoline, diesel, whatever. And that'll be our problem because they twinkle-toed away back before there were laws that said you got to remediate before you can leave. And then the one across the street, much bigger, it's just sitting there. It's an eyesore. Because, unfortunately, the company doesn't have the money to get rid of the USTs, and they have to now under current laws. So there's that. Yeah, you'll have shutdown costs. Sometimes, even when you don't expect there to be shutdown costs, you'll see that in an example in just a minute here. And then you got your decrease in net working capital. which actually is a positive because you're unloading inventory that you don't have to replace. You're burning off the last of your prepaid expenses that you don't have to pay, prepay again. Okay? You're also going to have some, you're going to have to finally pay off all your bills, your current bills, but oftentimes this decrease in net working capital is a plus to the cash flow, to the free cash flow. Operating versus capital expenditures. First of all, operating expenses, those are the ones, as they say, from day to day, month to month. Your salaries, wages, and all of that. Your light bills, your water bills, your internet fees. Those are operating expenses. Your mailing, your shipping. I should know this from heart because I just finished doing my business taxes recently. Literally, the business tax form, it starts with like 20 categories, and then you can just add as many as you want. Please limit your number of categories to less than 200. Really? I mean, I was grateful to get away with 18 categories. But make sure you know there are a lot of different expenses, and you're going to need to project them. Capital expenditures, that's the big stuff. Capital, long term, more than a year, that's that big grunt when you carry it in machine. That's the stuff that comes in on trucks and gets plopped down. That's the capital expenditures. That's the payment for trademarks, word marks, and all that. Last year, I started in June to get a trademark for my company, get my company's name trademarked so it could not be touched. It was a requirement for me to get an Amazon storefront, for Amazon.com to give me a storefront. And I mean, the $225, well, that's why don't I just put that as an operating expense? Because that trademark is permanent on me. And it wasn't just $225. There was a round of deficiency. It was minor deficiencies, but I had to fix that. And of course, now I've had to completely throw away all of my business cards, my rack cards, and all that because I have to have them with that little circle R now. So those capital expenditures can be sneaky on you. But yeah, even the minor capital expenditures, if it's going to last more than a year, which a trademark, of course, does, you got to recognize it. Pulling it down and drilling this home. Now, if we're doing straight line depreciation on this, your operating expenses. Now, if you're redesigning a plant, that's going to be an expense. That's not a capital expenditure. You're just doing some decorating. Think of it this way. Me, I would probably go to Bed Bath & Beyond for the curtains for the factory. Worker motivation is everything. And of course, online I can get Velvet Elvis paintings, more motivation, music, and how, I mean, I'm going to have to spend money on 8-track tapes for Barry Manilow and, you know, Luther Vandross. These are things that you have to put in, and these are expenses, as opposed to the stupid factory itself, which is capital, and I do straight line. The real companies did MACRS, obviously. But I mean, when I first designed this, I didn't know how much those folks had of knowledge of accounting and all. It turns out most of them are very good at accounting, although their rules and their tax system are different from mine, and I didn't want to hear about it. And unfortunately, they decided to tell me about it, which made me want to kill myself because I'd already heard the American version of it, and now I hear other countries. Forecasting. Real life. Your sales are going to suck at first. Don't despair. If your sales are, you put all this effort into your company, sir. Okay, your sales for the first year were $18. 15 of that was from your mom. The other 3 was from you. That could mean one of 2 things. Your product really, really does suck. Or it could mean you have to hold on until the market begins to be aware of your product. Well, how do I do that? That's something that I make fun of, that is something I should never make fun of. It's called marketing. No, if no one knows about your product, no one's going to buy your product. And that's not going to happen right away. There's going to be consumer resistance. There's going to be consumer awareness. There's going to be consumer comparison. All of those different things are going to come in. And they're not going to happen at first. You're going to have terrible sales at first. When I've had companies, I've had young people come to me and show me, well, this company, we're going to be selling like hotcakes right out the door. Okay, you go right out the door, because that is not going to happen. You're going to need to find your price point. That is hard as hell. You come down to my office. I've got some of my works of art in there. And I like to ask my business students, okay, look at this. What do I charge for it? What do I sell it at? Because there is no, as my famous saying is, there is no God of pricing. I never, ever woke up in the middle of the night and heard, fat boy, you should charge $5,000. It never happened. You got to decide. Charge a low price, you'll bring people in, but you got a low price. Charge a high price, you're going to have people walk right away from your product, but those who buy it are going to put in heavy cash flow. It's a balancing act. I've got up on an art show. I put up an art show. Probably, I would say 80% of the people who walk in admire it, they stare at it, and then they find that little price tag and they look at it and they flip it and walk right out. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, your dog's ugly too, lady. Yeah, that's the way it is. I charge a high price and I pay the price for that by losing customers right and left. But when someone really wants it and that person has the money for it, I could drag them out and they'd run right back in to buy it. That's just the reality of it. But that's not the only strategy. The most successful companies on earth did not Hail Mary their price. They were selling things that were pennies and nickels a piece to make their money. You got to decide that. Cost. Be honest about your costs. Don't, well, it'll cost $1 million. No. You call suppliers. You call the people who might work for you, see what they want as far as their price goes. You find out what rental space costs for your storefront, if you got a storefront. What leasing is available per square foot. How many square feet are you going to need? There's a cost. Get the hard numbers right up front. And then this horrible thing, the curse of free markets. If you're successful, every son of a bitch is going to come in and knock your product off. Guarantee it, I promise it. I had a company, one of my very first consulting projects in the 1980s. Back, have you ever seen an original Atari? You know, the one that was on TV and you did things like Pong, Pong, Pong. Have you ever seen one of those? Oh, yeah, maybe at a museum, yeah, from the Stone Age, to hell with that. Now, Atari started coming out with more games, but they were just these, like, 8-bit things, the block stuff. It wasn't even, well, Minecraft is like, no, this was real lame. By today's standards, but back then, OMG. We didn't even have OMG back then. LOL hadn't happened yet. But anyway, and the controller was relatively simple. There were games coming out. And I mean, they were kind of choppy and all that. These two geeks in Columbus, Ohio, heard of me as a consultant. They wanted to bring together enough capital to put in an order for these gaming controls that they had made that turned Atari into something really awesome. I mean, you could do things that normally Atari couldn't do. Atari, the controller couldn't do. They had coded in, it was just a work of art. And they were both, you know, classic nerds and just kind of really not very marketing oriented. But they had already had the prototypes built on Taiwan. And they showed me their prototypes. They had like about 10 of them. They were phenomenal. I mean, it looked more modern than the controllers of its time. They looked more like 90s controllers, the big stick and the buttons around it like that. More like the 90s, not like the pads today, but they were more modern. And I got together on a Reg D 504, $500,000 for them to put in their first order to start putting them on the shelves in these nice colored boxes. It was all ready when it shipped out from Taiwan. It would be in the box, wrapped in plastic, pretty box, instruction manual, all there and shipped over here and ready to be distributed to stores in the Midwest as the pilot market. Everything was incredible. I mean, it was very exciting. Got to $500,000 together, had put in the order, and I got a panicked call one morning. Our controllers are already on the shelves. And I initially, you went around me to do this? And they said, no, they're not ours. They look just like ours. Even the box looks like ours, but they're not ours. Well, where did they come from? It says made in China. Made in Taiwan, rather. Well, guess what had happened? The company that they had paid to build theirs, they built them themselves and they put them over here on the shelves. They had them on the shelves before we could even get the damn order in. You remember that. Next time someone says, nuke the competition, no, I'm a pacifist. Control that word, that. Let them nuke your competitors. For most industries, competition reduces profits over time. Others will come in, they'll bleed off your profits, they'll knock you off. That's why it really is worth it to get trademarks. Patents are expensive and they are time-consuming, mind-numbing. It doesn't hurt to do it. Incremental revenues, here we go, rock and roll. Okay, you're going to, I'm doing this flat. And again, it's a simplified version, the ones that I show you later, and I'll finish this on Wednesday, but this is a simplified version. Okay, your incremental costs. Notice that you've got that extra cost that's initial. Remember I showed you that you've got your initial outlays that are operating costs? So you're going to have negatives before you even have positives to balance your negatives. It's just going to be the way it is. That's why you need that seed capital. That extra money. And don't think, well, I got money in the bank. You would not believe how much money it might take. Don't skimp. Because you're going to be really sorry if, well, we'll save a little money here and there on things up front, and then once our revenues come in, we'll make up for it. Don't do that, because those revenues will never come in unless you've built things up front so the revenues can come in decently. Okay, and then your depreciation. And by the way, this is $1.2 million was the initial cost. I've never did put that in the PowerPoints. I forgot to. And it's flat. It's flatlining. It's straight lining. Yeah, flatlining is a good word for it. Okay. EBIT, you just drill it down, incremental revenues minus incremental costs minus depreciation. And by the way, this is, I do recognize, this is kind of boring up front. And I'm filling in a lot of detail because I'm kind of hoping that you are going to actually be the hope of the future, stupid as I might be for that. So I've got to show you how this really actually works. And it's not that hard. It's just dumb stuff. Okay? Now, you're going to crank it. You've got to look at your marginal tax rate. What is the last dollar of earnings going to cost? So in other words, whereas your first dollar of earnings might cost you 15% of it, that first dollar, Uncle Sugar is going to take 15 cents of it. But if you are making huge money, that last dollar, Uncle Sugar is going to take more than double that. And Don't work on the assumption, I'll find lots of loopholes like all these companies that pay no tax. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're not going to be that lucky. You're going to pay taxes out the nose, and you are actually going to be grateful for it. The last thing you want to do is get funny with your taxes. Let those desperately rich people play their games with taxes. You just pay yours. And you do it gladly. Because then, even if you do get one of those random audits, you walk in there fearless. Just deal with it. Just take care of it. Don't try to cheat. Don't try to find the extra loophole. Well, it's legal, so I'm going to do it. Don't. You'll be really sorry if the auditors come. And there is not enough Imodium AD on the shelves at Walmart to cover you to cover the bowel problems you'll have the day before an audit. Trust me on that. I'm speaking from experience, by the way. Do it right, and then you're not afraid of an audit. Income taxes. Earnings before interest and taxes times the firm's marginal corporate tax rate. Now, there's one missing in here. I'm not doing interest payments on this first one. In other words, we are looking at an unleveraged example, And by the time this lecture is over, I will have already thrown 12 terms at you, new terms. And remember, I loves me those new terms on pop quizzes and on exams. So this is an unleveraged example. In a case like this, we would be talking about something where we would get equity investors in this one, okay? So here it is. The incremental earnings off this project. Now, these are only earnings. These are not free cash flow. We've gotten down to the sweat line. We've gotten down to where the accountants can't go any further with us. You, madam, are an accounting major, am I right? You're my tour guide. You're leading me up to the edge of the jungle. Okay? But you see, you know why they pay accountants a lot of money? Because they're very smart. You're going to stand at the edge of the jungle. I'm going to look into that jungle. I'm going to hear all kinds of scary sounds. I'm going to smell smells that are really frightening, including what smells suspiciously like cooking people, you know, cannibals. Okay? And you know what you're going to say? Remember, you're smart. You're an accountant. End of the road for me, fat boy. And you send me on my way in. Okay? That's the edge of the jungle right there, okay? And, of course, being finance majors, okay. And you end up being a meal in a capitalist world. Okay, yeah, this is the end of the accounting. Now from here, we walk the hard road in. A lot of the things that you see now, new technologies, wow, this year only. Boy, there was nothing before this year. History means nothing to anyone except those losers. You'll see that a lot of these projects, they've been years in planning. These things started long, long ago. And in this case, a wireless home networking appliance. You know, we see those. Yeah, this project happened years back. Because you see, these things have to be, there were pioneering companies, Cisco. Now, the notice of something important. Are you familiar with Cisco? Okay. You think of Cisco as a B2B company, a business-to-business company. This was Cisco's. Cisco had done marketing research, and they found that there was a positive valence on the word Cisco among many people. Hear the name Cisco, It's something you can trust. Even though most people, although they were interacting with Cisco in their businesses, they didn't know it, they had a good sense of this name. So Cisco thought to itself, okay, why couldn't we leverage that name along with leveraging our existing understanding of technologies? We're good at this. People like our name. We like what we do. So their idea was, why don't we make a venture into the home market? Don't hide who we are. Cisco. Home networking by Cisco. Wow, we can do the same things that Fortune 500 companies could do in our home. That's right. They were actually smart in this. They were ahead of the field. And they had no blind spot. They knew that eventually there would be companies pouring in, but they could do it first. Get a good whack of revenues, set the field in motion, and more importantly, begin to set the standards for others who were coming in. Unlike what happened in the 1980s, where there was no early push of one company. We had developers in the operating systems for personal computers. They were all over the place. We had IBM doing its PC DOS. We had others doing theirs. We had Bill Gates come in and steal the whole thing and call it MS-DOS, Microsoft DOS. Then we had Steve Jobs come in with his Mackie stuff. It was just a mess. Cisco could essentially, as an 800-pound gorilla, set up a much smoother transition into this world that you know about years back. Okay? This isn't like in the 1990s, but this was when you were still kids that all of this was becoming. And this was Cisco's movement into it. It'd have to have a router, a physical machine, and then it would have to have the software so that these coffee pots and things like that, refrigerators, could talk to the internet. And eventually that would, and I'll show you a company after this, that was involved in what came after this. You all know about the internet, right? Okay. There are actually several internets. There used to be something before the internet. It was an internet, but it was called ARPANET. But then there was the internet, which has been around, it's actually moving into 40 years, yeah, no, 30 years now. But there's another internet that is out there too, and it is the one that is scary, and it's also the one you probably know very little about. It's called the Internet of Things, the Internet of Things. An internet that is only for things to talk to each other. Keurig uses the Internet of Things to talk to Keurig about what you're doing. Alexa talks to the Internet of Things to have things, other things do what it tells them to do. It also talks back to its parent company to tell the parent company what you're doing. That's the Internet of Things. You're not on the Internet of Things directly. Only your things are on the Internet of Things, which is kind of scary. This is the first round. Cars, the latest cars, are on the Internet of Things, and they will become more so. By 2022, your car will tell the police that you were speeding. Yeah. Good luck with that. Well, I'll fix that. No, you won't, because then it'll tell that you're trying to jimmy it, and there will be laws to prevent you from jimmying the stuff. And, of course, then the hackers will come in and make your car do a Watusi down the road. Make his car do a breakdance. Now let's map his reactions and put those into our database of people shitting their pants. Okay? I'll let you go for the day. We'll get this done on Wednesday. Thank you.